Thank you, Chris. Of course, you know how much I love to be back in Berkeley. But, you know, can't deny it, the Max Planck is a wonderful environment too. Especially for experimentalists, actually, because, as you will see, and I'm trying to tell you a little bit about it, this is a kind of an area of research where the progress in technology and instrumentation is really rather important. And the progress you will see depends crucially on all the kind of progress in high-resolution work which is now possible. Unfortunately, the light from the back is making it a little hard to see. What you see actually is already one kind of an experimental tool we are using, which is there is an 8-meter class telescope, and there is a laser, and a laser pointer, a pretty expensive laser pointer. To orient yourself what we are looking at. There, in case you had any doubts, that's where the center of our Milky Way is. So the issues which I'll discuss, I hope you can see this, not too low here and obscured, are a number of issues. Of course, the black hole itself, and I'll basically tell you in the middle of the talk what we now can say about the testing of the black hole paradigm. And I think we can be fairly sure the statement I'll make is that we have compelling evidence for a black hole here for once, a massive black hole, as long as you accept general relativity. So you can challenge general relativity and we still have to go further. But I mean, if you accept that, I think we can be sure. The surprising things then which I'll talk to you about, once you accept the black hole, there's two issues which I'll discuss. One is we're discovering an enormous amount of star formation around this black hole, which is absolutely not expected. In fact, presently not fully understood. And then the general paradigm of black holes is that they're happy to accrete. They're most efficient producers of energy if you have accreting gas onto a black hole. That's how quasars are supposed to work. Well, a galactic center doesn't accrete very much, apparently, or doesn't radiate very much, and that has been an embarrassment, so I'll tell you what we now know about that one as well. Now, of course, the motivation, briefly, is that we now, in astrophysics, are pretty sure about a lot of evidence from distant active galactic nuclei and their energy production, imaging of these objects, following them up to the various highest redshifts, that these quasars and various other forms of active galactic nuclei associated with a high energy phenomenon like X-rays, gamma rays, variable emission, relativistic radio jets, and so forth, really plausibly can only be explained by accretion of matter, mostly gas, onto a massive black hole of hundreds, millions of solar masses, maybe a few billions of solar masses in the more massive objects. And the local census is now getting ever better, about 50 objects where you get sufficient amount of information from spectra and, of course, also imaging to delineate mostly the stellar, but in some cases also the gas distributions and their kinematics, such that you can make a statement about the amount of material within a few tens of parsecs or less, versus then the mass of the spheroidal component within which this mass resides. And this is the famous black hole mass sigma or bulge relationship, where on this coordinate in logarithmic units you see the derived dark mass, which in most cases in fact really is dark in the sense of when you have that mass, it is really not commensurate with, say, stellar condensation of the, you know, typical high luminosity, so it must be something else. And then here the mass of the bulge. There, by the way, is the Milky Way. So it's in fact a rather meager example of this relationship. But of all the points here, it's the most secure one we now have, and that's the part of the story. So we, in astrophysics, anyhow, are fairly sure that black holes exist or likely exist, and that they, and that is another part of the story, probably have a very important role to play in the evolution of galaxies. Now, that's not part of the talk, but it's, of course, part of a research of a lot of people, some of you, of course, as well. Now, in the galactic center, the first evidence that there may be a black hole there, so to speak, in analogy to what then was speculated about in the early 70s in quasars, came from the work of Charles Townes in Berkeley, Nobel laureate for the laser. What he did at the time was pioneering work in mid-infrared, that is 10 micron spectroscopy. The Charles Townes group built spectrometers which could look through the dust, which is between us and the Milky Way center, rather easily, and they observed spectral lines, like in this case. These are profiles of neon 2, neon plus emission lines, a fine structure line at 12.8 microns, and then they placed various apertures in the vicinity of this radio structure called the mini spiral. The radio astronomers at that time were beginning to get also pretty good arcsecond resolution quality imaging of the continuum emission. This grayscale here is the radio continuum emission, showing this extended ionized gas spiral here of gas, which we now know indeed is basically our streamers, tidally disrupted streamers of gas swirling around the center. And in the middle of this is a compact radio source, Sag A star, discovered, you know, in around the same period, early 70s, where this source, as I will tell you, is extremely compact and very, very bright, brightness temperatures of 10 to 12 degrees or so, and clearly could not be of stellar origin, and at that time already was known to be, so to speak, in the center of the Milky Way, because the stellar distribution is so generally centered around it. So these neon 2 observations, which you see here in these apertures, showed, in fact, for the first time then, although very coarsely, that the line centroids move around as you move around this gas filament here by velocities on the order of several hundred kilometers per second. So you take a varial approach, and Townes' group did that in the late 60s and early 70s, and basically showed with ever increasing quality that in this region of about 10 arc seconds, that's sort of a third of a parsec or so, there must be a mass then of about 3 million solar masses. So this was, you know, 1970 something, and of course since then, what we've done is to improve on this to scales from a third of a parsec down now to 10 light hours, and we still get the same result. So Charlie was really right. But of course, at that time, nobody believed the conclusion, which you find in those papers, early papers, that obviously there must be a black hole in the galactic center, because really Sag A star is fairly feeble. It's not visible at any wavelength other than the radio, etc., etc. Now, nowadays, of course, we have much, much, much better radio information, higher resolution observations of the VLA, which, you know, resolve this mini spiral gas. Also, spectroscopy is available. But the key point is really Sag A star itself. Intercontinental, in the VLBI, has shown that the size of this object really is extremely small. In fact, this is the most recent work from the paper by Bauer et al. There's a second paper by Shen et al. Coming to the similar conclusions, namely that the intrinsic size of this radio source, and here let me make a parenthetical remark, it should be easy, you would think, to image this radio source, but it isn't, actually. Why? Well, because as we're looking through the Milky Way, of course in the optical there's this obscuration which I mentioned, in the radio waves, the same interstellar medium has electrons in it, and those electrons blur the radio images. And so before you can deduce anything about the intrinsic source size, in fact, you have to correct for this. And that was pretty hard. But what you see here, indeed, is then the intrinsic size as a function of wavelength. So you see this is the centimeter range, and there's the millimeter range. And you see that the size, the intrinsic size, gets ever smaller, such that at the shortest wavelength we can really do VLBI at, you get 3 millimeters. You get about 10 or 20 times the size of the Schwarzschild radius of that 3 million solar masses, which perhaps might be the black hole residing there. So it's a very, very compact source. More recently, Mark Reed and collaborators have, with the VLBA, and for, before that, Don Backer with the VLA, followed the motion of that radio source with respect to two or three background quasars. So these are, of course, way a true inertial frame. And so over time you can see whether the radio source moves. And indeed it does. This is from the VLBA results of Mark Reed's in the component perpendicular to the galactic plane. The galactic plane runs down this way here. And so this is only that component. I'll tell you why in a second. And so you see indeed that motion is there. It's clearly changing position rather slowly, and remarkably so, exactly at the rate you would expect from the motion of the solar system around the Milky Way. Okay, there's a small component of motion, of course, perpendicular to the Milky Way, and that's that purple magenta line here. So you see the differential between the best fit, which is that dashed line, and that continuous line is a mere 1 kilometer per second. That is a measure of the intrinsic motion of Sagittarius star with respect to the local frame, not the inertial frame, but the local frame perpendicular to the Milky Way. And that's remarkable, 1 kilometer per second. Now, you could show the same thing for the motion in the Milky Way plane, but there, of course, the sun and the earth and everything moves around at 220 kilometers per second. So the residuals are larger, 20 kilometers per second. But in any case, we're talking about 50 microarc seconds per year. And so this object is more or less stationary in the best reference frame one can construct from those radio data. Let me briefly talk about a bit of the higher energies already. Come back to this later on when we talk about accretion. So for a long while, many people looked for sources, initially at very large scales. Gamma ray astronomers, for instance, discovered all kinds of sources and rejected later on that this was Sagittarius star because they found other nearby sources. So the story for a long time was quite confused until Chandra came along. Chandra really opened up high resolution imaging and did show the existence of a source located really within, you know, half an arc second or so on Sagittarius star, although at a disappointing level of flux. So the radio flux integrated of all radio wavelengths is about a few solar luminosities peaking in a submillimeter, and the X-rays were, you know, about comparable to this. This is very, very small. So in terms of Eddington rate onto a 3 million solar mass black hole, we're talking about micro or even nano Eddingtons here. So that is not what a black hole is supposed to be doing. Now, most recently, there is a lot of talk about TeV gamma rays, which have been discovered initially by Hess, but also now the other Cherenkov images near the galactic center. Now, here is, in fact, the Chandra image, extended emission. There's the position of Sagittarius star. And here, this is the arrow circle in the position of the TeV source. So it's very close to Sagittarius star, although it's not variable, that's for sure. It's not variable. And the TeV community generally believes that the most likely explanation for the TeV source is indeed accelerated cosmic rays from a supernova remnant, which is close to but not associated with the black hole. So while it would be extremely exciting to see TeV emission perhaps through annihilation of dark matter or something near the black hole, that's the less likely scenario, although, of course, one can certainly speculate about it. Now, in terms of the infrared, let me give you a little bit of a feeling about the improvement which really has been made and which led indeed then to the possibilities of the various dynamic studies which I'll discuss about. So at the end of the 1980s, the first semiconductor near-infrared detector arrays became available, still very modest in size, 60 squared pixels. Okay, this is nowadays nobody would look at that anymore. But it was possible to construct beautiful seeing limited images like this from the work of Sharp and DePoy, where you now see here the various stars on a scale here of about a fraction of a parsec, 2.2 parsecs here, and the position of Sagittarius star is marked on here. So you immediately see there's not much there, consistent with what I told you. Now, these bluish-looking things are the somewhat hotter stellar components, and then the redder things are the cooler stellar components. So there's a very dense cluster here, very dense star cluster with a peak density of about a million stars per cubic parsec. So this is close to the densest star clusters we actually know. And so this disappointment here, of course, is A, well, there's nothing at the position of Sagittarius star, and B, you know, this is very blurred, of course, due to the seeing of the Earth atmosphere. what would one like to do? The experiment which many people, including us, were thinking of already at that time is, suppose you had very high resolution and there's a black hole of 3 million solar masses there, well, those stars should move. And as you go closer to the black hole, then they should move faster, like Kepler told us. So perhaps the experiment one could do is just measure the proper motions of these stars as a function distance from Sagittarius star and then see whether or not they would hold statistically at least to a Kepler law. That was our initial dream, but not with that resolution. Okay, so you have to first do something else, which is you have to improve your resolution. So at that time, a new detector came in, which turned out to be later the NICMOS detector. And so we then made a proposal to ESO to build a so-called Spica camera, which was capable of taking very fast pictures and mounted on the new generation telescope, which ESO just started operating on La Silla, the 3.5 meter. That has very good seeing, very good imaging, and so forth. So we started in 91, and the trick here is that in the infrared, the Earth atmosphere is a little better behaved than in the optical. So while indeed the seeing, you know, distorts the images, etc., if you make a modestly long exposure, like even a second is sufficient, in good seeing, then here's one of these frames, you can see that there's actually an airy ring here. And the resolution on these stellar images here is close to the resolution of the diffraction limit of that 3.5 meter. So that was sort of the first step, doing speckle imaging, but relying on the fact that in an infrared, unlike in the optical, often enough you have only one bright speckle instead of hundreds of speckle, which make the analysis in such a crowded environment virtually impossible. Here what you do, you just stack the images on the brightest speckle, basically using this guy here, this very bright star as a reference, and over time you build up an ever deeper, easy to analyze image, which of course still has crud around it, and that you clean away with a simple image cleaning rather than deconvolution. And then you get images like this. So obviously now you're jumping from say half an arcsecond to an arcsecond down to about 0.1 arcsecond resolution, and you see this bluish stuff and so forth resolved into hundreds of stars. That is when in fact we knew, hey, we do this for a few years and we see these stars move, and they did. So after about 5 years, we had our first result, and indeed the Keck group, headed by Andrea Ghez, using of course the then operational Keck telescope, being much larger, started a little later, but they also were getting proper motions of these stars relatively quickly after a few years. Now the crucial breakthrough really then came with the combination of the big telescopes and adaptive optics. And that's really the story of the last few years. Both the Keck telescope and the ESO VLT have been major players in this, remarkably so. Not Subaru, and Jim and I also not so much, perhaps because really these two players have been sort of dominating the field a little bit. But anyhow, now the key thing is that these big machines have been equipped with very, very high quality images, and more recently with so-called integral field spectrometers, which are able to couple to adaptive optics systems. So this imager here on the VLT, in fact, is a combination of a big infrared imager, which you see here in blue, in red colors, with this big machine here, which is the adaptive optics system, which analyzes the wavefront as it comes in and uses a deformable mirror at a frequency of a few hundred hertz to a kilohertz to undo the effects of the Earth atmosphere. Now, in fact, another revolution is taking place as we speak, which is to equip the AO systems with artificial laser guide stars, which allow to use this technique wherever you like. I mean, the probability to find normally a star, a bright enough star, close to a target which you've picked is near zero. It's essentially zero, especially if you're an extragalactic astronomer. But the laser helps, and so, in fact, all the big telescopes, well, at least Gemini, Keck, and VLT are now equipped with operational systems, and I'm sure this kind of a technique will become the norm for high-resolution imaging in the next few years. So That is the next step then, with natural star but infrared wavefront sensor AO. In 2002, the VLT produced these kinds of images, already bigger because the detectors were bigger, but also the resolution now is not anymore 0.1 arc second resolution, but about 40 milliarc second resolution, so another factor of two better than that, same with the Keck. Now the field of view is still limited because both the detector array and then because in this case, you're using this star to do the wavefront analysis. With the laser, Keck did first a big panorama in 2005, and now you can see you can point wherever you like and get these wonderfully sharp images. So that's really the progress in resolution, and the resolution then is coupled to progress in astrometric quality. And astrometry, of course, is what we want to do here. We want to measure the positions of stars relative to each other and follow over time. The motions you expect are a few milliarc seconds per year or less. So at the initial, what we could do just after we were switching on the speckle, we were beginning to get sort of the kinds of astrometric quality which was barely enough, but that improved rather quickly. So in the mid-90s, we had about 20 milliarc seconds, and that was then enough over 5 years to see the first motions. Then both Keck and the VLT improved with the big telescopes and the AO very rapidly to the level of 2 milliarc seconds. Then another thing happened, which you will see, we were beginning to see not just motions, we were seeing orbits or elements of orbits. And now both groups are at the level of 500 microarc seconds. So that's a hundredth of the beam, a hundredth of the resolution. That's about as far as you can push it with the kind of imaging. But that's not where we want to stop. We want to go on. So at the end of the talk, I'll tell you how we get to another factor of 100, which is interferometry. And coupled with this improvement in astrometric precision also came improvement in sensitivity of stars, which you can do at that resolution. And you see, back then we could only do the brightest stars. Now we are tracking sort of pretty ordinary B stars and normal giants, and we hope to go down to A stars as we go into the realm of interferometry. I should say that most of this limiting magnitude business is due to confusion. It's not the raw sensitivity of the device. I mean, you can in principle integrate much longer and get even deeper, but you cannot get rid of the confusion. So you see, these are healthy factors of improvement which have been possible over the years. So now let me tell you about the results. And before I come to the black hole story, let me just start with, it's easy to do it that way, with the issue of the stars themselves, which of course are our trace particles for the black hole. But now let's assume for now you do know already that there's a black hole. And it's located right here. What would you think you should see? Well, you go to, papers, various famous papers. McCallum Wolf, for instance, tells you that you should see a singularity power law distribution of faint stars centered on the position of the black hole. Well, let's examine the image in front of us. Is that what we see? Obviously not. We see that they are bright stars, and they're certainly not centered, on Sagittarius star. That was noticed already in 1980s. And in fact, papers were written which that showed compellingly that there was no black hole there. Now, of course, I said faint stars because this process of forming this cusp takes a long time, goes through relaxation processes, which in this case about a giga year in length. So these stars here had no time to relax because they are much younger. And that is what we learned over the last years. Now, when you go indeed to the faint stars, which you can do with adaptive optics techniques, and count only the faint star surface density distribution, sure enough, there is a peak of the stellar background distribution, so to speak, right on Sagittarius star. There is a cusp. If you measure its surface radial surface density distribution, it follows an inferred density distribution with r to the minus 1.3. That's shallower than the Bacall-Wolf solution of r to the minus 7 over 4, but that is understandable given various issues here having to do with, number one, this may not trace all of the stars. We only may trace, so to speak, a component of the stars. And in fact, further in, there's mass segregation, that the stellar remnants are more frequent than the stellar remnants we cannot see with this technique. We can only see the visible main sequence stars, etc. Plus, a cusp distribution in a multi-mass system is shallower than the so-called Wolf's solution, etc. And in the central part, there's collisional effects which would additionally flatten the distribution. So, to first order, this is indeed what we should have expected to see. But, as I said already, the stars, which really sort of are obvious, are not necessarily old. There are old stars, and the majority of the stars are old, and you can distinguish these from other stars in spectra, like this, for instance. Here, you see these absorption features in the near infrared, and these are very, very, very old giant and AGB stars with temperatures around 3,500 degrees. So these are the oldish but luminous component in the galactic center. But starting in 1990, evidence became ever more obvious that there were, especially amongst the bright stars, young stars, massive stars, luminous stars, O and B stars. It started with objects like this here, which in this object right here, which shows very strong emission lines due to hydrogen and helium. If you look more closely, you see even P Cygni profiles, which indicate winds. And so these stars are very, very luminous objects, about 100,000 to a million solar luminosities. They are losing mass at the rate of 10 to minus 5, up to a few by 10 to minus 5 solar masses per year. And are, you know, post-main sequence blue supergiants. So clearly these objects must have formed recently, unless they were not formed in this region and were brought in, or somehow another process is possible to rejuvenate an old star and make them look alike. So initially there was a lot of speculation about this, but then now we have so many stars, about 100 of them, and we've got all the different stars which are known to exist and occur in other H2 regions. We have Wolf-Rayet stars, that's a WN star, that's a WC star, and they are normal stars. They are normal O and B stars with profiles which really do not distinguish themselves in any way, shape, or form from any other O and B star in the Milky Way. So that stellar content here is rather normal for a star-forming region. And indeed, there are other star-forming clusters nearby which have similar stellar contents, only a few tens of parsecs. So it's hard to escape the notion that there are young stars in the galactic center. The question still arises how they are formed. I come to this, but they seem to be there. And indeed, in one case so far, we have absolutely clear-cut evidence that this is a massive star. One of the supergiants I just showed you is actually an eclipsing binary. There's the eclipsing light curve, and there's the velocity profile of the lines. From this, you can calculate unambiguously the mass of the system. Comes out to be 250 solar mass Wolf-Rayet stars at a distance basically touching. I mean, it's a touching system almost. So clearly, indeed, this must be a massive system. And there are about 100 stars, as I said, and counting. It's really just a matter of time and investing telescope time. And if you look at the blue circles, for which, you know, every one of them is a star, you notice there is obviously a concentration really right around where the arrows are, where Sag A star is. And there seems to be sort of a reasonable outer region here, outside of which there doesn't seem to be so many of these blue circles, at least in terms of the O stars. That's so far absolutely true. We have not found any O star or Wolf-Rayet star outside of the central half parsec region, although with B stars we are more successful, so there may be some somewhat lower mass stars, and that's still an issue of progress. Now, we have for these stars spectra, we have for them, of course, the photometric parameters, stellar models, so we know what mass stars they are, etc., etc., and we have their kinematics. We have two proper motions for each one of these stars, and we have We also have the radial velocity from the lines, so we know how they move. In a number of the innermost cases, we actually have also now acceleration, so we can deduce individual orbits. But for the majority of the stars, we have basically 5 of the 6 phase space parameters. So in a statistical sense, we can ask the question: is whether this system we are looking at here is randomly distributed or not? And the surprising answer is that there are definitely 1 and probably 2 disks of young stars in this innermost half parsec region. These disks, one is sort of inclined like this, and the other one is more or less face on, and they're orbiting, they're rotating around the center, they're probably somewhat thick. There's one disk has probably fairly low eccentricity orbits, the other one has higher eccentricity orbits. All of this is being worked on by the two teams working this in some detail, and Jonathan can be the witness here. He's been at this conference we just had comparing notes, and there's large agreement and there's some disagreement. And you know, the disagreement, for instance, is whether truly there is a second disk or whether the second group of stars is perhaps scattered out of the first disk, etc. But definitely is one very well defined stellar disk. So now, how did this disk form? How did these young stars get in there? Because clearly, non-coherent two-body relaxation cannot bring a star from any distance outside into the center within the lifetime of that star if the star has a mass greater than 2 solar masses. And we're talking about stars of tens of solar masses, so clearly they cannot have by themselves migrated into the central region. That's absolutely out. So what are the options? Option number 1, first proposed by Bob Sanders, is basically gas falls in, being dissipated, forms a dispersion ring, over time circularizes, and then over time becomes dense enough to overcome the next big problem, which is of course the tidal forces of the black hole. The tidal forces of the black hole are enormous, such that a star at a distance of, say, a tenth of a parsec, sorry, a cloud at the distance of a tenth of a parsec must have a density in hydrogens per cubic centimeter of 10 to the 9 particles or greater, and correspondingly more when you go further inside. And that kind of density gas is not seen in the galactic center by any means. So the normal clouds which we get to see in this vicinity of the galactic center cannot form stars by the gravitational collapse of what you guys are studying. Absolutely not. You have to do something to it. So Bob Sanders' speculation, and that of others then following Jeremy Goodman and others, is basically that over time you form basically a gaseous accretion disk, a cool gaseous accretion disk, supposedly the black hole is off, which then over time, you know, through MRI and other processes, you know, becomes denser, contracts, and then on becomes globally unstable through Tumor Q, and then, you know, forms stars in a hurry. So that's option number 1. Option number 2 is to bring in the stars in the train, using the fact that by dynamical friction, a big star cluster, which you might have more easily formed outside of the galactic center, can over time spiral into the center. If the star cluster is massive enough, like say a million solar masses or so, it actually can make it from say 2 or 3 parsecs into the central tenth of a parsec over a few million years over the lifetime of these O stars. The problem is, in order not to be tidally disrupted too far out, you have to not only make it massive, you have to also make it dense enough. And that brings other problems with it, one being that that massive and very, very dense star clusters like this actually are not seen anywhere in the Milky Way, including the galactic center. So they are either very, very rare or this is improbable. A third possibility is various games with scattering. If, of course, that's well known, you have a star on a lost cone orbit, so it comes into the central region, then it may be circularized in the innermost region, especially if the big black hole is surrounded by a cluster of stellar black holes, which over time you would expect to be able to relax to the region around the big black hole. So, for instance, suppose you have a B star, 10 solar mass B star. B star is on a near lost cone orbit and then makes a three-body collision here in this innermost region, which is resonant, in fact, because the stellar black holes also have about 10 solar masses. And so the cross-section is enhanced by resonance. Out goes the stellar black hole pendulum experiment, and in stays the B star. Or if you bring a binary in, you can use the Hill mechanism and so forth. So there are various mechanisms with three-body collisions which people have thought about. More recently, the most popular thing right now are so-called massive perturbers. One of the issues here is, of course, how to bring the stars onto the lost cone orbit. That's a very slow process. And so once stars are sort of disappeared from the lost cone, it takes a relaxation time until they're refilled. But if you out here have a lot of massive objects like molecular clouds, they can scatter B stars into orbits into the center. So there are various proposals. None of them presently is in any way successful to explain the numbers of stars we see. Maybe the one or the two, and perhaps, as you will see, the innermost ones. But in fact, they cannot explain this disk of young stars. So the progress over the last few years has been a fairly detailed analysis, in fact, of the dynamics. As I said, we know that these disks here in red and blue have a very steep surface density distribution. Surface density goes like r to the minus 2, so they're very dense at the innermost edge, within which there are no more O stars, in fact, and then they rapidly decline, as you see here. Another key feature is that we know very well now that the age of all the stars can be explained with a more or less singular burst model of an age of about 6 million years, plus minus 2. And within that error bar, of course, you can have, you know, continuous star formation or anything else you like. And so, by the way, that is true for the blue subpopulation as well as the red population. So indeed, if there are two disks, it must have been two events at the same time, more or less, perhaps related even to each other, which nobody understands right now how that could be and lead to two disks. So there's a lot of discussion, but it's very, very clear there was a clear event, and that's the time when these massive stars formed. And then a very strong constraint is now available on the mass within these disks. And that comes from three different pieces of evidence. One is just counting the stars to the as faint a level as we can do, and then extrapolating, you know, with an IMF you derive from the data. Another one is basically to look at the kinematics of these stars. Now, if you have these two disks, of course, then they present to each other a non-central disturbance of the gravitational potential. And so over time, the stars in each one of the disks, as a result of the action from the other disk, start to persist and scatter, and the disks start to thicken. And so we know what the thickness of the disks are, etc. We know what the mass is, as what the ages is, sorry, and then from that, that's work by Sergei in action, we can constrain the masses which can be in the disks. And then finally, this is also work from Nyakshin, there is a constraint on the content of the low-mass stars, the Tetori stars, from their X-ray emission, because the X-ray emission is measured, and so that presents an upper limit, to the contribution from all the Tetori stars. Now, in reality, of course, the X-ray emission is more strongly bounded by, you know, the stellar winds crashing into each other, etc., etc. But even if you took the total amount of luminosities from X-rays, you cannot allow, in fact, even if you take that mass, a normal IMF down to the one solar mass range. Anyhow, from these three constraints, the mass of the disks is nowhere 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6. So I think it's pretty much now a consensus in the field that the combination of these various factors strongly favor in situ formation, perhaps not fully excluding an infalling cluster scenario for the weaker disk, but I think strongly favoring for the bigger disk in situ formation. So clearly there must have been an event. Probably the event was indeed, as proposed by Sanders, inflow of gas at some point, formation of a dense disk over time, etc., getting dense enough to overcome the tidal forces and forming stars in a hurry. Now what about this most central region? So now we're going to within the region from which we see O stars. And here is in fact an image of the central region. That's Sagittarius star. That's one light month there, that circle. And so you see these images. In fact, these are not images. These are data cubes. This is integral field spectroscopy at the diffraction limit, 50 milliarcseconds of the VLT. So we have spectra for each and every one of these stars. We can tell what kind of star it is. And so we can, for instance, look for absorption lines due to bracket gamma, which is an indication of being an early type star. So we can mark the stars in blue and red, whether they are blue, early type, or red, late type, old and young. Okay, so you look at the blue and red circles, you see there are lots of red circles out here, right? And the occasional blue circle. Once you're inside this central light month, you know, more or less everything is blue. In fact, there's two or three red circles, and of those, we can exclude that these, for instance, these two red circles are probably interlopers based on the velocities of the stars. So they're projected rather than actually in that volume. So essentially, at this point, 90% of the stars which you can spectroscopically identify in the cusp, that was part of that cusp structure, are young. They are not late, old, small, and so forth stars. Absolutely unclear. Not understood. In our conference, Jonathan, I guess, people were looking for explanations and lots of good ideas, lots of good theorists, but no explanation yet how they came to in this innermost region. But let's be glad they're there, because they are our, you know, pride and joy for what comes next, namely to look at the black hole, because they give us reasonably bright targets now to study the motions of the stars. So again, here's this innermost region, and in fact now the proper motion experiment, which I began to talk to you about, delivered in the mid-90s, then basically these arrows for each star, sort of the length of an arrow. And actually, in addition to the arrow, to make it a little more clearly, I've actually done it this way, that I show you three images here from 2002, 2003, and 2004 in red, green, and blue. So you can actually see with your eyes that some stars move so much in a year that they're easily seen. For other stars, it looks more like a prism effect, right? And other stars, they're white. So it's easy to see. Qualitatively, the motion of the stars increases toward the center. You can do that with the arrows too, and you can do it statistically in outcomes of Kepler law. Okay, so statistically, that's the evidence we had in the mid-90s, that within a light month or so, in fact, there must be a mass, and you can calculate from the velocity curve what that mass is, and turns out to be Charlie Townsend's 3 million solar masses. Okay, and that excluded most configurations at that time already, but some still could be things other than a black hole. So the story since that time now has been orbits. And I should say by the mid-90s, we were making little movies at that time, dream movies, sort of vision movies, where you would, you know, show how these stars perhaps could move. I could show you one. It goes over about 100 years. That's what was likely going to be the case. 100 years for an orbital timescale, which tells you, well, you know, if you're very long-lived, like Charlie Townes, maybe you could have a shot at it. But for normal people like us, not so likely. But that, you know, nature sometimes is good to you, and nature was good to us. And so while that was 96 when the first motions, we had the first motions, 98 when Keck Group had the first motions, by 2000 the Keck Group had the first accelerations, and by 2002 we had this wonderful event. Both groups found that this star S2 had moved from up here, and by the way, on here you see the VLT data in red and the Keck data in yellow. I apologize, I do not have Andrea's measurements since 2003. That's not that she hasn't been measuring it anymore. I just don't have them, okay? I know what they look like, but... So both groups saw that star move, you know, nicely down towards Sagittarius star. That's where Sagittarius star is. And then in 2002, all of a sudden, we saw it on the other side. And then we could see the motion of that star on a monthly scale. It was moving here at a rate of about 5,000 to 8,000 kilometers per second. And then since then, it's been quiet and more quiet. And This year in June we celebrated 15 years, 15.2 years, which is once around. Okay? So that thing is on a beautiful Kepler orbit, which is that light blue line on the centered on the astrometric position of Sagittarius star, which we now know to about a milliarcsecond accuracy. Now, not only do we have, of course, the motions on the sky, we also have the motions in radial velocity. There's that first motion from the Keck group, and then we've been doing this Keck also, and so we see this. So we have the three-dimensional structure of this orbit really very well measured, very highly precisely measured. It is a point mass. It's within that 15 light hours, which was the pericenter distance, that the same 3 million or 4 million solar masses, etc., etc. So it's clearly a point mass which resides there. So that's sort of the status of the black hole hypothesis from an experimental point of view. We can measure with ever better statistical precision the mass, although, and that's something which you also discussed extensively in Ringberg, there are large systematic errors which have to do with reference frames and so forth. I don't want to bore you with this. So the second error bar is a systematic error bar which is dominating now the statistical one. And in fact, that affects the present accuracy of the galactic center distance. I should say you can determine the galactic center distance in a primary fashion from this very precisely, right? Because you have the motions on the sky, you have the motions radially, and so you have the full three-dimensional structure, and there's one fitting parameter, and that's the distance to the galactic center. So you can do that, and you get about 8 kiloparsecs, and we published this, and the Keck group has been working on that. But as we were getting better data, our statistical accuracy would increase enormously until we started seeing, it has a systematic component to it. And that's unfortunately the situation right now, that both groups are exploring how large are these systematic components. And so I would say, while we thought we had already an accuracy of about 150 parsecs, that's a statistical accuracy, okay? The systematic accuracy is not as good. Now, when you take that mass, and then also the fact that you know that the radio source in the middle of this, and the radio source is not moving, so it's clearly the massive component. The radio size is about 10 light minutes. You can then deduce a lower limit for the density of that mass, and that comes out to be 10 to the 20 solar masses per cubic parsec. A black hole of that mass is about 10 to the 24. So we actually be getting there. I mean, I should say, this is of course the equivalent density. I mean, please, I apologize to the theorists. I mean, this is the equivalent density within the event horizon, okay? Not the singularity or whatever the else there may be. Now, we are looking for deviations from the point mass in two ways, deviations from the Kepler one. One, of course, there must be an extended mass component, and that would manifest itself in a retrograde precession, a Newtonian precession of the orbits. We don't have a detection right now, so we can set a limit to a few percent of the point mass. I would say presently that's not yet interesting. It takes a little longer. We need a few more years. Then we come down to the level of about half of that or less. That's where all the predictions would definitely predict a black hole, solar black hole cluster of that mass, and we should be able to begin to see that in a few years. Perhaps more excitingly or not, I don't know, the special and general relativity effects. In principle, we can see them already if we have a good peri. So if we had that S2 peri, but now with all the guns we have available to us now, which we didn't at that time, we would see beta squared effect definitely. But we will have to wait until we see the next big peri, and then we can see these effects. But the really big step is the interferometry. So here's a collection of our stars, and I show you now sort of, you know, what we know about their orbits. We are tracking about 40 stars now in their orbits. We have about 40 orbits, more or less good orbits. S2 is just one of them. That's the innermost one. And you can see the characteristic of these stars. All of these are young stars, is that they're really rather more random. So unlike the disks, which are just outside of this region, this is a completely, you know, as best as we can tell, random distribution of orbits, likely due to scattering. Some, in fact, are close enough that lens tearing over the lifetime of the star can, in fact, precess the orbit, but most of them cannot. I mean, they are too far away. Okay, so then where do we stand? And sort of an executive top level statement here. So what this is the size of the object you can think of in units of the event horizon of a 4 million solar mass black hole. That's the density in the way I've just defined them. And here are various objects. So there's the densest cluster we can think of, including the galactic center star cluster. There on the other side is our black hole. And then there are various other scenarios. Of course, perhaps initially the most likely ones seem to be collections of neutron stars and stellar black holes, which you can just collect somehow into this central region and suppose it's in there. But then you have to ask the question how long they live. And so if you say they have to be plausibly longer lived than 100,000 years, that puts a upper limit here to that density up here, so it has to be living down there. And then there are some more speculative scenario, like for instance a very heavy neutrino, for instance, which could form a fermion ball, or various types of boson stars, etc. All of these are highly speculative things, especially this guy here, because in this case this wouldn't even be stable if you have baryonic accretion onto it. But in any case, the data already exclude most of what you see here. What's left is this upper corner. So obviously we have to battle that boson star and or not. or be happy. So that's what I said. If you believe general relativity, and some of it was used here, then in fact we are pretty, you know, this is solid evidence. Now then you talk to various people and they come up with all kinds of good ideas. So those, of course, you know, they're very hard to distinguish. A gravitational star is essentially, you know, from a size point of view, you know, the metric looks just like a black hole outside of the event horizon. And dark energy stars also, you know, two within 1.1 Schwarzschild radii look pretty much alike, etc. So this one I don't know. As a simple experimentalist, I don't know. This one, I think we can get closer to it, as you will see. So, last part of the talk is on the accretion. Being now a black hole, we believe that we want to see, you know, a good amount of radiation. And indeed, as I said, some radio emission, a little bit of X-ray emission with Chandra, but nothing in the infrared. And there, in fact, you see the discoveries which happened in 2003, both from the VLT and the Keck, of the first infrared flares. So it turns out every few hours in the galactic center, typically every 4 to 6 hours, the galactic center makes a little gulp and a burp and starts spitting out various radiations. Here's a burp, the best burp we've seen now. In April, this April, there down there is the infrared emission at 3.8 microns of the VLT, and at the same time we had everyone observing it. We had the HST, we had Integral, we had XMM, various radio observatories, etc. There's the XMM emission. This is the first time we have a beautiful X-ray light curve, in fact, showing that a infrared flare and an X-ray flare, in fact, occur pretty much at the same time. That's a very strong constraint, although in detail they're a little different, which is also highly interesting, because various models having to do with, for instance, inverse Compton would have predicted that they are identical, which is not what we see. So there are some very interesting things. There is here, as you see, some obvious wiggles. And there is an ongoing debate between the two groups doing this. So this is one of the areas where we do not agree whether or not these wiggles here occur at a specific frequency. So here's the periodogram, the Fourier transform of this curve here. And you see there is a peak, clearly. This is significant, quite significant. There's a logarithmic scale here at about 20 minutes. And we keep seeing these 20-minute type or 17-minute type effects. Our colleagues at the Keck feel that they don't see it. So we need to still get better data to understand whether what we are seeing are basically red noise phenomena of a noisy fluctuation spectrum, or whether this is indeed a fundamental frequency. If it is, for instance, a Kepler frequency, then you have a measurement of the spin. As long as you assume that what you're seeing here has a radius near the last stable orbit. So there's several assumptions come together. If you assume this is emission near the last stable orbit, and this is a Kepler frequency, then you know that the spin of the black hole is around half. half of the maximum curve. So that would be interesting if indeed true. At this point, I would say one has to take that still with caution. The infrared emission is highly polarized, about 50%, and the polarization swings on timescales of the same kind of dynamical timescales of tens of minutes. That's highly interesting because that tells us the magnetic field structure is clearly coming around. And so we are trying to, in fact, the observational campaigns, it's very difficult work, I should say, is trying to catch these polarization flares now, flares in polarization, and follow these angles and see whether we see a sort of a constant angles which give us preferential directions, etc. But there's a lot of obvious potential here to study the region right around the black hole environment. I'll skip that graph, which has more to do with, you know, what the X-ray and infrared emission is due to. Let me just summarize and say, I think there's a general consensus that what happens here is that the electrons in the innermost accretion zone are at about gamma of, say, 10 to 30, so about 10 MeV. That's the virial temperature. From time to time, there is a transient event, a heating event, a reconnection event in the plasma, the magnetic plasma, which heats a few percent of the electrons to about gamma of 1,000. At that point, these electrons make near-infrared synchrotron emission. That's what we see as a flare. Now then the interaction probably of these fast electrons which have been created here with the bulk photons and the submillimeter emission which come from the virialized electrons then upscatter the photons into the from the submillimeter bump to the X-rays. So that's sort of a short version, a zeroth order version where everyone agrees. Now, as I said, if that were true in detail, well, then you should see a detailed correspondence in the light curves, which we are beginning to see breaks down. So we need to think more clearly. This is probably more like the solar coronal event where you have flux tubes expanding and various high-energy particles running away from the reconnection event, etc. So this is probably very dirty physics in a way, and hopefully not too dirty for the last comments I want to make. So then let me say something about the accretion. Why is Sag A star so damn faint? First statement is most of the accretion happens from the gas which is ejected by the stars in the vicinity of a black hole. So it's the stellar winds accreting onto the galactic center. It was thought that when you go to large scales, that it's actually the gas from molecular clouds, which we've been discussing this morning. In fact, if you do a naive interpretation like this, take sort of the mass in the molecular clouds at a scale of 50 parsecs, sort of derive the non-circular motions, then you came up with that kind of an accretion rate. That's a very large accretion rate. You do the same measurement at one parsec, you already see, you know, something is not conserved here, or you made a mistake in your assumptions. Well, if you do this at the actual Bondi radius of the black hole, you're down to now 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6. So that already tells you that that gas really had nothing to do, on average, with the accretion flow into the innermost region. That gas, you know, either stays out there or basically orbits through the region, never makes it into the... And even that gas does not make it into the hole. We have now a beautiful measurement of the Faraday rotation from submillimeter observations by Dan Maroney and Jim Moran at the SMA, which constrains the number of electrons right around the innermost radio source in terms of a mass loss rate, accretion rate, that's 10 to minus 8 solar masses per year. But that 10 to minus 8 solar masses per year is indeed consistent with the emission. So something gets lost between Bondi radius and something. Two orders of magnitude gets lost. And that probably has a lot to do with the accretion physics, which is very, very complicated. Now then there, of course, is time variability, and it has to be recognized that because it's the stellar accretion from the stellar winds, this is strongly dependent on the angle and on the momentum distribution of the stars. So in terms of very, very sophisticated modeling of the accretion flows, what is understood now is that that low Eddington flow is a combination of a low accretion rate already at the Bondi radius, low efficiency angular momentum transport in the magnetized plasma, probably a low efficiency energy transfer from the protons to the electrons, although that lately, Quartet has been working on this, is more and more doubted. But then finally, that everyone agrees on, most of the gas which actually makes it to a few Schwarzschild radii is ejected back out, and only sort of 1 out of 100 protons which enter the Bondi radius make it into the black hole. The story for cosmological simulations is, of the number of gas particles appearing at 100 parsecs, please, a minute fraction goes into the event horizon. So assumptions where you basically say, well, everything which makes it into the Bondi radius of a big black hole ends up in the event horizon, to me, look awfully naive. Finally then, are we done? Chris asked me this already. We're done, right? We should go home. Done. Enough. Well, actually, some of us are excited now to go a next step for the galactics and many other regions and using interferometry. So the VLT here has 4 telescopes and can be interferometrically combined with baselines up to 200 meters. So that's 4 or 3 milliarcsecond resolution, another factor of 10. And we are now proposing and studying a very complicated interferometric 4-beam imager, an astrometric instrument, which, and just look at this one, then is supposed to be doing 10 microarcsecond astrometry. On stars near the galactic center or on gas. So for instance, the flares. If the flares really, is gas in a few times the event horizon is 10 microarcseconds. And so if it's, at 40 microarcseconds out there and is orbiting, well, we should be able to somehow see that in the motion of the spot. And so in fact, there are simulations by a number of people. This is from Avi Loeb and Broderick. Here, what the polarized flux distribution at different times will look like, and perhaps one can see that motion. One cannot image this. That's not possible, but can see that motion of the gas in the innermost region. And in principle, of course, the metric, is ingrained in that image motion and, in fact, accessible then to the observations if the physics is not too dirty. And of course, is the glass half full or half empty? 20 years ago, when we started the Galactic Center experiment, nobody would have thought that we have beautifully orbiting stars which go to 15 light hours. Anyhow, that's the story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Weiner. Questions?
Tests in general avidity, for example, we have very good tests, for example, depending on the volume and various effects, on solar system mass scales. But at galactic mass scales and cosmological mass scales, we have only qualitative tests. But this system, either through lensing or perhaps the details of the orbits, would seem to permit you to, in principle, measure the so-called post-Newtonian parameters that parameterize the deviations from general relativity. What are the prospects for that?
Well, I mean, for the stars, okay, for the stars which we already love and see and observe, these post-Newtonian parameters to at least beta squared, perhaps a little more, can be measured, there's no doubt. Just accuracy, precision, and working on it. We presently don't know, but are looking at stars which probably are there and a little further in. At which point, the precessions will become definitely accessible. It's just a question of seeing these stars. I mean, that's presently not possible because they're probably too faint and we've been blinded by various effects. The interferometry will tell. And then, of course, that is on scales of, well, probably, say, 50 to 100 Schwarzschild radii. So that's still moderately low curvature. And then, of course, the flares may very well then test the ultimate limit, but then in a not predictable fashion, which we can't know. So these are the 3 stages. Out there at 1,000 Schwarzschild radii, we definitely will be able to measure. It's just a question of doing it and to what extent of the post-Newtonian parameters we can do this. And then further in, we don't quite know how good the stars will be. And innermost, we don't know how good the physics will be.
In the in-situ star formation scenario, do we have enough massive stars and a tight enough constraint on the number of low mass stars to say that this IMF is unusual?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If it's in situ star formation, what we can say presently is that in the equivalent scenario of a power law IMF, it has to be flatter than Salpeter by 1 to 1.5 decks. So it's really rather flat.
Okay.
Very roughly, it seems like the two puzzles you've raised might be related in the sense that if the dust is all going into forming new stars and it's not falling into the black hole, they're all the luminosity. Is there any chance that there's a connection?
Oh, well, yeah, no. In fact, there's another issue which I wanted to bring to the attention of the star formation crowd. We have other data on nearby AGNs, and which may suggest, in fact, because the most common accretion mechanism in AGNs, not in quasars, but in AGNs, normal AGNs, is the stellar winds, that there must be a strong connection, that you have to go through the star formation process before you downgrade enough of the angular momentum so that you can feed it into the hole. Or the other way around, if you send gas in there, what you're going to do is form stars. Yeah? I mean, to me, that's... If I see what I see now, I think that's... Barring disastrous events like a major merger of two galaxies in the end phase, which is maybe a totally different kettle of fish, but sort of the more modest Seyfert-like phenomenon, I just don't think that you can assume it's, you know, a gas feeding line goes from 10 parsecs through a bar, from a bar flow, you know, all the way into the event horizon, just straight in there, fed into the MRI disk. I think it's more likely that indeed you see star formation events, and then the accretion which you get onto the hole is strongly modified by the time at which the stars emit the lowest speed gas, and that's in the AGB phase, and not in the O star phase, by the way. In the O star phase, your Bondi radius is fairly small. In the AGB phase, it'll grow, because then, of course, you're coming with very slow speed outflow and a lot of gas, and so that is sort of the scenario we are speculating about in the AGNs, that you first form stars, then you have to wait for 100 mega years or a few more, and then you get a boost from the AGB winds to feed the black hole.
So what is the observational evidence for that?
Observation evidence for this is that in nearby Seyfert's, where we're using the adaptive optics integral field spectroscopy technique, without exception, we're beginning to see evidence for stellar disks on scales of 2 to 10, 20 parsecs. But they all seem to be outgoing. They are not actively forming stars. So these are picked on, with the trigger here is I pick a Seyfert nuclear. So that's picked on the basis of when the AGN is on. And these things are a few hundred mega years old. And so if you go through the star formation process and calculate, is that perhaps a special time? I'm telling you, it is a special time, namely when the AGB stars kick in. While, you know, the galactic center, of course, is an odd time because, yes, you have O stars there, but the O stars, you know, have very fast winds and they don't like to accrete very efficiently. And there are not that many, of course, also. Yeah.
What do we know about magnetic fields of this object?
Of the Sag A star? Well, I mean, I told you that definitely we know that the radio emission and the infrared emission is polarized, and the models would tell you that the inner accretion zone is probably near equilibrium, so that 30 Gauss type fields is sort of what everyone, you know, assumes. They have not been measured, of course. Polarization is consistent with that. Further out, what is known is, this is in the outside of the Bondi radius, of course. The magnetic fields are present, but not very strong. They are, you know, in terms of energy, about a hundredth of virial. But you meant the innermost accretion zone, presumably. Yeah.
The galactic center is known as some sort of outflow or wind. And what do we know about either the size of the region it's launched from or the amount of mass flux? in that way.
Do we? This was provocative, first of all. I'm European, you know, so. I mean, morphologically, you're right. There's a lot of structures which you can say, oh, wow, looks like, and so forth. And in X-rays in particular, I would say, pretty good evidence. Have we seen kinematic evidence which supports this?
I thought there were some observations of halo stars where they saw some...
Halo stars. Okay. Halo then, oh, well, then we have the X-rays. Okay, look, there's the 6 keV hot emission. I mean, but what drives that is a yet another issue. I'm not sure I'm willing to speculate on that. You're probably right.
There should be a very large number of black holes. You mentioned that before. I mean, really large.
Yes.
This is
100,000, say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, is it understood that perhaps because of a strong tidal field, why these black holes should not show significant accretion?
Ah.
Visible?
Good.
The tidal field of the central black hole that makes it really hard. What is it?
Well, you know, why does a big black hole not accrete? It's not the same issue. But indeed, there are.
They're trouble forming stars at 100% efficiency. The black holes can't accrete.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Now, it is true that some of these black holes are on part of the time. That's not clear from X-ray observations, right? So you see these transient features. In fact, if you look at the Chandra transients, they are concentrated in the central region.
Well, there are transient features observed in the central region.
That
will get to you large number of black holes.
Yes. So I mean the accreting black hole phenomenon as such is supported by the data which do exist. But that doesn't mean that your sort of first comment, you know, why are they not accreting at Eddington, given there's so much gas around. To me, sorry, I have to say that's the same argument as the big black hole. Yeah.
No, I didn't say Eddington, but I mean there should be this process of forming stars should have started since the black hole was born, which was early on in the in the sphere of the galaxy.
Yes.
So there could be hundreds of thousands of black holes.
Absolutely. I'm all with you.
So I'm not even sure that the number of transient events would be consistent with having hundreds of thousands of black holes.
Yes. Well, I don't know. We have to read the papers. That's Muno and others, and I'm not. I have to say, I just must confess, I'm not quantitatively well enough on top of that issue. But how do you find them out? I think that's what we're trying to do. If you go further out into the cluster, of course, very hard to do this because even if it's you say 100,000 black holes, well, there's a million stars. I mean, there's a million solar masses stars and 100,000 solar masses of black holes. Very hard to distinguish. So where we have to do this is in the mass segregated part of the cusp, where there are no more stars or very few, and then the black holes. That's the experiment we are trying to do, which is to see dynamically whether we can see the. And indeed, as I said, the most likely scenario is at the level of a few by 10 to the 4 solar masses within the range we're probing there. That's where we should see detection by all means. Absolutely. I'm with you. Yeah.
What are the prospects for determining the star formation rate history over, say, 100 million lifetime scale?
Oh, well, that has been...
Yes, stars are not necessarily 6 to 8 million years old. Can't really tell.
You appreciate the talk as it was probably too long, so I didn't want to. Yes, there's another line of research here. One is to understand the B stars, and turns out we now have actually a believable surface density distribution of the B stars, which is rather interesting. We can talk about that. I mean, you know, I showed it briefly in Ringberg, perhaps you. And so that may be very different from the disk, etc. distribution. Then for yet longer periods, yes, we have a very good study by Holly Manus, you student at Berkeley with us, on the AGB stars and basically tracking the so-called red clumps. So these are the horizontal branch stars, and basically modeling there. And the surprising thing is that we are missing the faint horizontal branch stars. So that could be either meaning that early on the galactic center nuclear cluster didn't exist, formed late, very heretic, but not impossible. We are a late-type spiral, you know. Or, perhaps more likely, and that's what Holly is favoring, is a top-heavy IMF. So you would have then, you come to the conclusion that also in earlier epochs you formed stars in various bursts and so forth, events, but the top heavy IMF is sort of a general feature of the star formation process in the galactic center, as would seem possible from Sergei Naikshin's simulations, right? Because you have this confinement to a disk where you can, you know, you're forced to go around in circles around the black hole, and you're more easily gobbling up gas over a long period of time.
Do you anticipate getting information about the angular momentum of the black hole?
Well, again, if you believe, but you shouldn't believe, if you're willing to consider the evidence of this quasi-periodic work, well, that if that's Kepler frequency, we do have evidence already for a spin. The next level is the magnetic field work we're doing. If it would turn out that we are seeing a stable direction of the field there, I mean the average direction of the field, that could tell us something about the direction of the spin of the black hole. The magnitude, well, we have to see. Lens tearing precession of the innermost stars, which we hope to do with interferometry, in principle, in the lucky cases, might be possible. Okay, they have to just be, you know, far enough in. That's really the issue. And then we come to the flares again, and the astrometry of the flares. If that's a good tracer, well, then of course we can definitely measure the Kerr metric, I would hope.
Yeah, Tom? Do you see any extinction differential along an orbit?
It might be, but you know, I think what we can say is from star crowns and, I mean, basically color distribution measurements, is that the central few arc seconds are about as free of variations in dust as you can imagine. By the way, giving a lot of trouble to earlier accretion models. I mean, I showed you this Huadra's simulation of this sort of formation of a local accretion disk from the winds, and if that were dusty, as it would be, this the WC stars are dusty stars, you might expect to see something like this, as well as recombination line emission just from the ionized gas, and that's not seen. We are not seeing an orbiting accretion disk at 10,000 degrees in the Bondi region. We do not.
Okay, why don't we thank Lionel again?
Thank you.